Welcome back, everyone, to the Disaster Tough podcast, where we share insights into the big plays and right calls of leadership. We dive deep into the stories, lessons learned, and ideas that will help you in the field. Let's go. Welcome back to the podcast. I'm your host, John Scardina. I am so excited for this episode. I just had a great, like, 5-10 minute conversation with Judd before we even started. I was like, oh no, we should be recording this. He has so much experience all across the field. When we talk about getting out there and being able to know your job, it was so easy for him, even in the beginning, to walk through all the different experiences he's done. So I'm definitely going to ask him to do it again. But from our perspective in emergency services and trying to make that disaster tough call, you know, there's so many conflicting things that happen. To be able to interview somebody who has a ton of experience in the military side, in the public side, and working through natural and man-made incidents, as well as, of course, war, it's incredibly special to have somebody like Judd Mathews on here. And so, you know, when we talk to him, please just keep in mind of what you can do in your field, whether you're a firefighter, if you're an emergency manager, or if you're in the military. The lessons he's going to be providing to you will make you exponentially better. This guy has so much experience. We're really lucky to have him on the show. So with that being said, Judd, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, John. I'm thanks for that introduction too. I'm really excited to be here, and hopefully I can leave your listeners with something that they can get some utility out of, that's value added to their to whatever they do in emergency management or consequence management. And I'm super excited to be here.
Well, not to use a WMD bun, but I'm pretty sure you're going to blow everybody away. So we're excited for the episode here. Let's talk about some of your experience. You really have done basically everything under the sun, and you shared a couple with me from riots to WMD to, you know, the war landscape. Can you walk through, just for the sake of our audience, what your very storied career includes?
Okay, I'll go ahead and date myself. I graduated high school in 1986, and I joined the Louisiana National Guard. And it was my first, I guess, first day on the job, the first weekend that we had an assembly. We called them drills, and there was a riot at the Immigration and Naturalization Services prison in Oakdale, Louisiana. Sure. And that was the beginning of, you know, kind of the civil support domestic operations, DISCA. And so DISCA means different things to different people. We think it stands for Defense Support to Civil Authorities. The folks at DOD that do security cooperation thinks it stands for the Defense Security Cooperation Agency. Both very important. However, when I say DISCA, I'm talking about Defense Support to Civil Authorities. And then living in Louisiana, I mean, it's the disaster du jour, right? It's mostly tropical weather, hurricanes. But I mean, if you think about it, didn't even have to be a hurricane. You know, a tropical storm off the Gulf Coast. If tropical storm winds hit New Orleans, for example, which is in between the Gulf of Mexico and like Pontchartrain and the Mississippi River, you're going to have flooding. You know, dealing with flooding in a city that's 13 feet below sea level is a daunting task. And then, you know, at the policy and strategy, I went on active duty in 2002 because of 9/11, deployed several times, I think six years in total to Afghanistan and Iraq. But I did get to work at the policy and strategy level at headquarters DA and then at National Guard Bureau. So, and then it, you know, 2020 was probably the year of the most National Guard utilization for consequence management, emergency management, DISCA, DOM ops. We had 120,000 National Guardsmen on duty at the time, working everything from hurricanes. Remember, there were two Cat 5 hurricanes that hit the coast of Louisiana in the same spot, Lake Charles,
yeah,
which is where I'm from. That's where I was born and raised. Maybe I'm just bad luck. But anyway, but then the wildfires that year were unprecedented, and then the civil unrest, starting with the George Floyd riots, to what happened post January 6th, as far as the presence that the National Guard at one time had up to 23,000 service members on the streets of D.C. Not all at the same time, obviously.
Right.
So. Yeah, I think I've pretty much...
You've got the gamut.
The L3Harris Extreme 400P radio solves problems and is specifically designed for emergency services. How do we know? We field tested it with medical, urban search and rescue, and collapsed and confined structures. This radio is amazingly tough. Check out the L3Harris Extreme 400P radio at L3Harris.com right now. If you served in the military, you've probably worn Proper Apparel. Proper Apparel is now reaching out to first responders and those who love the outdoors. Check out Proper Apparel from the outdoors to the EOC, wear proper. How do you spell Doberman Emergency Management? EOP, OEP, HVA, HMP, Thyra, TTX, Drone, PDA. Whenever you need an expert, Doberman Emergency Management field experts are there for support. Contact an expert at DobermanEMG.com today.
You know, and I asked this question to then Colonel McKinney, who's General McKinney now, and big shout out to him in UCOM. Hopefully he's doing well. But, you know, the National Guard has such, and I think I brought this up to Erica Bordeman, too, on the podcast. Now, she was very opposite because her dad was military and she didn't want to be a military. But the National Guard gets involved in so many of our disaster responses in the U.S. And yet the relationship between the National Guard and civil is, for a good reason, a couple degrees removed. But I feel like there's so many lessons learned that we could learn from each other as a National Guardsman, as going out there and dealing with so many different incident types. Not just the natural hazard stuff, but the man-made stuff as well. What are some of the big lessons learned that you were like, oh, I wish those emergency managers from the other side of the house would learn this about either military or about the National Guard specifically? Like, what lessons could we gain that you have implemented well on your side of the house?
Well, I mean, a couple. And there's more than a couple, but I mean, the two that I've always lamented over was interoperability.
Yeah.
You know, and we've done, I mean, we've made gigantic strides with regard to interoperability, how our tactical communication systems and radios can talk to, say, like a state police smart radio, you know. Interoperability, interagency coordination prior to D-Day. Left of D-Day, H hour. D-Day is not I know you've heard this. That's not the time to be exchanging business cards. So, you know, how do you get around that? Well, exercises. And they don't have to be large scale exercises like NLEs, national level exercises. I know that, you know, there are some municipalities that do every year, they do local exercises. And, you know, there's two things, and they're not dichotomous, but they are really different. So you have governors, and look, the governor's in charge of his state. I don't care what the flavor of disaster is, what the level of response is, that governor's in charge. You know, if you want to go in there, you need to go in there the right way. You got to get his permission.
Yeah.
You know, it's like the Marines landing at Long Island during, you know, Superstorm Sandy. And, you know, the tag at the time just basically said, we'd love to have you guys here, but go away and come back the right way. You know, let us know what.
Yeah.
You know, so that interagency coordination left of D-Day, And I think that can be accomplished through a lot of different things. Exercises is just one of them.
It's my favorite way, honestly. The exercises piece is such a
It's a simple way to get in the mud with somebody without having to get in the mud with somebody. And, you know, just having some kind of experience where you can bond over something is infinitely better than nothing, honestly.
And you don't have to exercise all your capabilities. You can focus on communications. I mean, or it can be a tabletop exercise, a tabletop exercise where you're just moving pieces around on a chessboard. But they are invaluable, and I don't know of anything that provides more utility and more value to interagency cooperation and the coordination that you're talking about, and that will reduce those degrees of separation between, you know, state emergency managers and state emergency response personnel and federal emergency response personnel, i.e. FEMA, DHS, and the National Guard, because the National Guard operates under some pretty broad and pretty unique authorities. I mean, there's not a whole lot they can't do. In other words, they're not statutorily restricted by, say, U.S. Title 10, which is the Department of Defense. Mm-hmm. Title 32, which is National Guard, allows them to basically support just about any other agency that's operating under any other title and authority without, you know, getting, you know, in trouble for, you know, a purpose violation for using equipment. They can operate in state active duty, which is just kind of unlimited. I mean, you're only limited by your resources, you know, and your state budget. And you're not even limited there because every state's constitution has emergency management assistance compacts in there. And those things are worked out way left of D-Day between governors and their adjutant generals and their emergency managers where, look, if Louisiana's got a tropical storm in the Gulf and it's about to cross that imaginary line that runs from the Yucatan Peninsula to the tip of Florida, there are forces mustering all around the country to launch. So that's the third thing I'd say, is understanding the titles and authorities and the capabilities under which the National Guard operates and what they bring to the table, and understanding that they may be first in, but they need to be first out as well.
Yeah.
Because I was involved in.
You guys are expensive. Real talk. Look, I mean,
we're expensive, but it's, look, I would live in a country where I can look across the street and not see a guy in uniform walking around with riot gear on. I mean, that's just not, it's not a good optic. I mean, that's not an American optic, right? So you want to enable those civil authorities as fast as you can and get back to what you were doing before D-Day.
I think you just figured out the title of our episode, by the way, American Optics. That's cool. That should be the title of your next book. I don't know if you're writing a book, but when we get in there and, Hurricane Harvey, there was an incident where, I wouldn't say an incident, it's probably not the right word for it. There was an opportunity for an external partner to learn about the Stafford Act. And I was young, and they had all the, you know, the medals on the chest, the whole deal. And guess what? Stafford Act is still a thing. When FEMA gets in there and it has certain authorities, learning about everybody's authorities and what they can do is invaluable to help ease things over, because at the end of the day, people have to be able to make decisions. At the same time, the biggest thing that gets involved, the biggest problem in every single disaster is personality. Every single time. If you can get people to be on the same page and same mission and the same goals, people stop bringing up authorities once they understand what those authorities are. They stop asking for things that they shouldn't ask for. At the same time, they want to be able to help out. And, the training piece is unique because with the Readiness Lab, we provide, I wouldn't say it's a monopoly, it's unintentionally a monopoly, but we provide a training with DOD, with DHS, with emergency management, with a bunch of other people. We call it dynamic populations. A lot of my audience knows what it is. Essentially, we do a counterterrorism training, and we put them in a location where they don't have any legal authority. They have all the responsibility as the emergency manager, but no legal authorities. And so how do you do that relationship. It basically forces people through a leadership mechanism of getting people on your side and working through puzzle pieces rather than making demands of things that you shouldn't be making demands for. So by the time they go back to their job and they do have the authorities, then they're able to work in together. But the problem with the dynamic populations course, as well as all other trainings, when I was in the public side, I don't know if you felt this way too, training was always the first thing that was cut on a budget item every single time. It was like, oh, you know, this is extra. And I figure, like, you know, our skills are diminishing skills. If you're not training, if you're not doing the interoperability, you know, in blue sky, if you're not training, then what are you doing? I don't know. It's a point of contention for me. I hope as people listen, they're like, oh, you know, Judd's saying it, John's saying it, other people are saying it. Training is so invaluable. And yet, for some reason, we can't get over that hump. I don't know what your thoughts on that are.
I'll quote the 300 movie. The more you sweat in practice, the less you bleed in battle.
Oh, I like that.
In training, you know, the more you sweat in training, the less you bleed in battle. It's so true. And you know, you talk about group dynamics, and you know the stages of group dynamics, you know, norming, storming, forming, and performing. We don't have time for that. That's why you got, you know, that's why you know, to your point about personalities, I mean, there's no time for that. And you talked about the Stafford Act. You know, once there's been a declaration of emergency, a disaster declaration, I mean, I'm not saying that the Stafford Act is automatic, but I can't remember a time in recent history where it wasn't automatic.
Sure.
You know, but the thing about the Stafford Act is it's reimbursable 100% up to a certain time horizon.
Yes. Those negotiations after,
you know, right of disaster. So right of D-Day. And so you really need to do those things, those important things that require interagency cooperation as fast as you can and up front, because the bill for the state starts increasing after a certain amount of time, you know, and so you don't want to be wasting time, you know, like I said, wasting time exchanging business cards and working through personalities. And again, training and exercises, I think, is the best way to have that interagency cooperation and form those relationships, you know, because a lot of, you know, the military guys were just, well, I retired, but I mean, yeah, you should say this about the uniform folks. We're all just passing through. I mean, we're going to be there 2-3 years tops.
Yeah.
But a lot of those guys, especially those GS employees, DOD civilians or DHS civilians, I mean, those guys have been there forever, you know. And
sometimes to my chagrin.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, yeah, it's like
trying to move on, man.
Yeah, they get famous, right? Even you hear this one person's name and you just cringe.
Yep.
But you know the value of and. There's no forcing function for their in-agency. George Bush tried to, Bush 41 tried to appoint an interagency czar, and it just didn't work. And it didn't work because of law, titles and authorities and funding streams. You know, I guess if the closest I can think of to an interagency czar is the National Security Advisor at the National Security Council, you know, because he's got those principles. You know, all those cabinet secretaries in one room but he can't force them to do anything. I mean, he doesn't, that's the limit of his authority. He can convene them, you know, and make suggestions, but it's a simple thing to say, but I think interagency cooperation is done over a cup of coffee.
You know, 100%. I go for meals. If I can get a meal with somebody, game over. You know, and people forget this about training. Training is not always just about training competency. Training is about relationships, figuring out what people tick. People will complain sometimes, like, "Oh, that person's so incompetent; they don't know their job." I'm glad you figured that out. Now, how do you work with that person? Because you still have to work with them, right? And so, you know, it's kind of a funny topic because there's so many people in our field. I'm the same way. We're all A-type. We want to get done. We want, at the end of the day, mission success, right? Like, it's all about mission success. You know, whatever that mission is. And yet, it's not the A-type personality stuff that gets things moving in a disaster. It's the text message. It's the phone call. It's the walking over to your buddy and say, hey, like, I was just told that we couldn't get these helicopters. Is there anything you can do for me? You know what? I know you. I'm going to hook you up. You know, like, whatever that is, you know, the relationships mean so much. And I've said this a few times on the podcast. I'm going to say it again. The day I read an after-action report that doesn't have communications on it, the day I get to retire from this podcast. Like, I'm so we can figure this out, right? And it does take the training piece. It does take those other things. From a guy from a response perspective, just kind of like moving into that world a little bit, in some of the disasters that you've been in, whether it's man-made or otherwise, what were some of the key takeaways for you? Like, what are the big highlights in your career where, like, that event changed my career because of X? Like, do you have, like, two or three of those events where, you know, it was game changer for you? Like, what were those events and the lessons learned there?
Yeah, and I'll just give you my top three. And getting back to what you said about relationships, I've said this in several different forums in mixed company. When it comes to interagency cooperation and domestic response, disaster response, consequence management, relationships are the center of gravity. I mean, that is the cog of that. I mean, it doesn't matter what capabilities any agency brings to the table, does it bring resources, money, you name it. Whatever means they have does not matter as much as it does the relationships.
Yes.
Then the communication, it's got to be flat. You know, yeah, you got to check your personality at the door, and for reasons we just talked about, sometimes that's difficult. I would say Katrina and Rita was where we learned probably the most in the last 3-4 decades about emergency management, consequence management, because you really didn't. I wouldn't say you didn't have an existential, I guess it depends on who you ask, whether it was an existential threat event by the loss of life, the loss of infrastructure, the loss of
supply chains,
all situational awareness. When there's zero situational awareness, you know, when every command center is underwater. And oh, by the way, you got another hurricane bearing down, you know, a little bit further to the west. You know, you learn a lot about how to manage resources and how to resource constrain, and then how to prioritize and how to redefine what an emergency is, you know, because, and the other thing, you know, that we learned about Katrina is, the accounting and fiscal piece of it. And I'll give you an example. The state of Louisiana got $1 million bill. That's $1 million bill from the Pot of Gold Chemical Toilet Company in New Orleans, Louisiana, for portalettes that they had dropped around the city that were just there and just stayed there. But the bill came after they collected them all up. So no one can even remember if some of them were there or not.
Oh, no.
The same with light sets. You know, light sets were the coin of the realm then. Yeah. And, you know, they were laying all over the place. And, you know, I remember being at Belchase, Louisiana, and a C-130 landed, and they rolled off 13 Humvees. And the loadmaster threw me a set of keys and said, good luck, buddy, and got back on that C-130 and took off. I mean, there was not even a 2062, which is a temporary hand receipt, much less a lateral transfer order. You know, so the accounting piece of it, it seems like the least of your worries at the time, but you better bring in some bean counters at the beginning of the disaster, because that is, I mean, we're probably still paying some of the bills here almost 20 years later. You know, when you consider that next year, will August the 19th of 2025 will be the 20th anniversary of Katrina.
You just dated me a little bit with the 20.
Yeah. The other big takeaway, I think, is from the George Floyd riots and what we learned about de-escalation. And the way that you present forces in an area of operations is going to have a direct impact on being able to de-escalate. If you show up looking like, you know, the stormtroopers, you know, on the Death Star, you know, fully kitted up, you know, armed to the teeth with a short rifle, with a sidearm, with the riot shield, with a baton, and looking like, you know,
you're going to go freaking kill them. Yeah.
You look like you're about to halo into Afghanistan.
Yeah.
You know, that is no way to de-escalate a situation. So I have found that the protective posture and I understand you got to protect your guys. You do.
Sure.
I mean, you got to keep them safe from harm, but the less they look like military, the better. I know you remember there were some riots in Kenosha, Wisconsin, and they weren't mad at the military. They were mad at civil authorities. So why not place the military in front of the civil authorities?
Yeah.
You know, and let them interact with the crowd, instead of putting the people that they're pissed off. I don't know if I can say that on your show.
You can. You're good. Yeah.
People that they're upset with out front. Yeah, I understand the military shouldn't be in the lead. No, that's unnatural. But think about the situation. You know, they weren't mad at the military. And so what we did is we put guys, they weren't fully kitted up, but the folks that were rioting looked across the street or across the skirmish line, and there's the guy that they work with at Walmart.
Yeah.
You know, do they really want to break bad with that guy? Do they really want to hit that guy with a brick or a Molotov cocktail? Absolutely not. It de-escalated the situation so quickly, you know, by putting the guard out front, because it was the police that they were pissed off at, you know? So that's another huge takeaway. And then I would say the third was the capital response, you know, the buildup of forces in DC after the January 6th incident, in that we learned real quickly how precious few transportation assets there are in the DOD inventory. And I'm talking about things that are managed by Transcom. And I'm not talking about just, you know, gray tails or you know, ships. I'm talking about the commercial assets as well. And, you know, we still had some stuff going on in the world. So you run into a simultaneity problem. You know, we have a simultaneous, whatever you want to call it, unprecedented period of civil unrest in the United States. But, oh, by the way, we're still operating in the sitcom AOR in Afghanistan and Kuwait and in Iraq and in Syria, you know, and you got to get those guys and those assets where they need to be when they need to be there. Right.
100%.
And so, you know, and I know the people that write the National Defense Authorization Act and then the Defense Appropriations, they know this stuff. You know, I've said this, you know, you can have all the disaster response you can afford, And you know, that's why we talk about the Stafford Act and the Economy Act. Yeah, it helps when you can open up some coffers and you can open up some purses of money that can be transferred between agencies by some mechanism, in this case, the Stafford Act, the Economy Act. But those are the three big disasters and the three big events and the biggest takeaways from each one.
The de-escalation thing, I think, is incredibly fascinating. You have worked in, and I'm giving some of the secret sauce away a little bit, but you've worked in so many different types of mitigation, mitigations of things, mitigations of problems, mitigations of people. And there's a buzzword, and I'm sure you know it, and this is really more for the field, but everybody brings up resiliency.
Yeah.
And I get a lot of flack on my show because people are like, oh, resiliency is so important. I believe in resiliency. I don't want to have to be resilient. I don't want to have to bounce back. And I would rather deal with mitigation first. And if we're outside of a response, even in a response, mitigation in my world is king. The faster I can mitigate problems, the faster I can find solutions and overcome those solutions. You know, it, just like with training and how, you know, it's better to, what did you say, bleed in the training ground versus bleed on the battlefield or whatever?
Sweat in training.
It's the same thing with mitigation. From a mitigation standpoint of things, of people, of situations, do you subscribe to that same kind of concept that it's better to mitigate than to be resilient? I mean, obviously, they're both important. I don't want to get rid of either one. But from a guy who's focused a lot on mitigation, where can we be better at mitigating things, people, or problems?
I think it's a sliding scale. You know, the more mitigation you do, the less resilient you have to be. Or the more mitigation you do, the more resilient you are.
Ooh, I like that. Yes. Yes. We're going to go with that one because then nobody has to give me crap for it anymore. The more you mitigate, the more you're resilient.
Yeah. But it's a sliding scale, or you know, it's the more prepared you are, the less you have to pay for on the back end. And resilience wasn't really a buzz word until the 2017 National Security Strategy, when they talked about, you know, these shocks to the system, these unanticipated, like a cyber 9/11. You know, and we've done so much since then in the cyber realm because, you know, we think that's where the next existential threat will come from. I don't think that people realize, and they shouldn't. I mean, no one thinks about this stuff. I mean, people, you know, they say all politics is local. You know, where I live in Louisiana, they don't want a whole lot. They just want low taxes.
Yeah.
And you know, but with my background in space and counting weapons of mass destruction, you know, I hate to quote Donald Rumsfeld, but he talked about the black swans and the unknowable unknowns. He said there's unknowns that you know about, and then there's unknowns that you can't possibly anticipate. And there's a book I would recommend to your listener. Can I do that? Can I recommend?
Yeah, 100%, please. Okay. Of course.
Yeah. So it's called The Gray Rhino, and it's no one can predict the future. The Gray Rhino, and but you can anticipate surprises, and you do that by doing vulnerability assessments. I don't know if we've done a vulnerability assessment of our critical infrastructure. But, and I don't want to scare anybody or be doom and gloom or, you know, the sky is falling, but I've been part of some TTXs at the U.S. Army War College when they took down the Dominion power grid, which serves about 4 million people.
Yeah.
The number of folks that die after 24 hours because their insulin goes bad is astronomical, you know.
Yeah.
So what investments are we making right now? I mean, it's great to talk about, okay, how are we going to come back from this shock? But why not talk about how can we avoid it altogether? Or how can we fortify ourselves against this shock? You know, how can we mitigate it? But, you know, it in our lexicon and in you know, the disaster management lexicon, we want to talk about mitigation.
The problem with mitigation and emergency management right now, and I've been beating people over the head with this, and quite frankly, I've had three FEMA admins on the podcast to talk about it. Too many emergency managers do mitigation after the big response. They have a huge hurricane, and they're like, oh, great, now it's time to enact my hazard mitigation plan and try to get grants. Like, you did it wrong. You know, the hazard vulnerability assessments, by the way, I just did a really cool one for the Portland Timber Soccer Stadium. That was really fun. But, like, that's you should be your foundation for everything. Your plans, your mitigation, your resource allocation, your training schedule. You could do all of that, and yet too many people are like, well, I don't know if I can convince my boss to get these new cameras or to harden these systems or whatever. We'll just see what happens. And it's always more expensive. It's a bigger headache, and people got hurt. So, like, what are we doing? You know, like, we need to overcome that a little bit.
Well, and, you know, again, you know, I guess we'll always come back to the value of training and exercises. But a lot of times you can tease out those vulnerabilities. Mm-hmm. Well, I would say that's the whole point of the exercise in a lot of cases. Yes, to build interoperability and build cooperation and rehearse your HR sequence. But it's also to tease out, you know, your blind spots and your capabilities gaps.
Yes.
And then once you've teased out your blind spots and your capabilities gaps in an exercise, that's when the hard work, in my opinion, starts. And it's mitigating those gaps in whatever capability is. And we're talking about, you know, people, time, and money a lot of times, but, you know, other resources as well. You know, and people don't want to have those conversations because, one, they're hard, and two, you get into, especially if you do an AT, anti-terrorism assessment on a facility, you know, you can start spending some money. And I'm not talking about a Lowe's or Home Depot either. You know, you're talking about technology that is expensive, but, you know, what is the risk reward calculus that you're doing? And I don't, you know, and it's a good thing that it is an American way of thinking to favor worst case scenario. I mean, we favor worst case scenario, but it's also the most expensive way to think. Yeah. You know, we don't allow, like, you know, realpolitik to creep into these discussions. Because then they would overwhelm and dominate the discussion, you know. But you can't plan in a resource unconstrained environment. You have a finite set of means. You know what your objectives are. It's just how do you marry those two things up, and you know, what are the shortfalls, and what's the risk represented by those shortfalls, and if it's, you know, if it's unacceptable risk, then you're going to have to resource constrain. In other words, there's some things that you're going to not do because you're using resources for that activity to pay for, your capabilities gaps. So, and brother, that is strategy. Yeah. You have ends and you have means, and the way you marry those two things up is strategy, but you can't just do it in a resource unconstrained way. You have to weigh it against risk, i.e. you're never going to have enough resources. So what do? You either adjust your ends, your objectives, and you scale those down or you limit them, or you increase your means. And again, the only way you're going to increase means these days is to rob Peter, you know. So what's the opportunity cost involved? In other words, what are we not going to do because we're moving money or we're moving resources? But the the tough conversations with regard to mitigation, that to me, that's like a never-ending OODA loop. You know, it's you know, and it's 360 degree assessments constantly. And I don't think we have, I think we lack the expertise, because what you said earlier, and look, it hit me with the subtlety of a sledgehammer, is it these skills that we're building as emergency managers atrophy.
Yeah.
If, you know, and we don't want to exercise them, or we don't want to be working out in the disaster. We want to, you know, we want to exercise those things, so we don't lose those skills, because they are perishable, you know. But also the education piece. You know, we talked about small space rescue. That school in Oklahoma for small space rescue is not cheap.
Yeah,
like what's the value of human life? You know, and that's kind of a red herring argument. I'm not trying to appeal to anyone.
Depends who you ask. You ask my wife and me. you know, my kids, they're worth a lot more than me.
Yeah, I mean, and that's not a red herring argument at all. I'm not trying to appeal to anybody's emotions. I'm just saying that, you know, if we want to do this right, we're going to have to make some hard decisions. And, you know, It's a risk reward calculus. You know, is the juice worth the squeeze? It's a cost benefit analysis. But it's the part of consequence management and disaster management and disaster response that you can't have enough of these conversations, the kind of conversation that you and I are having now, because you got to keep it in the forefront of the national strategic narrative. You know, do we have a national strategic narrative? I don't know. But if we do, we've got to be talking about how we resource defending the homeland, securing the homeland, responding to natural and man-made disasters, and mitigation, you know, because I don't want to find out how resilient I am. I don't want to find out how resilient the society is that I live in, the urban center or the town or the state or whatever. I want to go to bed at night knowing that we've done everything we can to ensure that we are resilient.
That's right. I have no desire to test my resiliency. I want my kids to have fun at the playground. I want to pick them up from school. I want to hang out with them. And, you know, from a guy who focuses so much on disasters, and I'm kind of a disaster geek. I get into it and I have fun with it in a weird way, as a lot of people probably can understand. At the same time, I don't want to experience them. I want to look at that tornado when it goes by my house and think, wow, that looks really cool, instead of, oh my gosh, what is happening? You know, and there's so much of the natural hazard stuff that we could mitigate. There's a lot of the man-made stuff that we could mitigate. And, you know, gosh, I'm going to get on my soapbox, and I don't want to do this too because we're out of time. But, you know, some of those things are obvious and some of them are not. And funny enough, I have found in my own life, going back full circle here, like the 360 optics here, American optics, you know, the relationship thing, being kind to people, giving people the benefit of the doubt, willing to train them, willing to work with them, has an incredible effect to de-escalate problems. You know, showing up in a polo shirt without riot gear, man, or just a t-shirt, whatever, fatigues, whatever it may be, can do more for stopping problems than anything else. We just did an active shooter training in Portland, and we were talking about de-escalation, and people don't realize how many active shooters come from the organizations where they worked. They always think it's some Hollywood thing where it's some bystander. No, it's because people are ignoring other people around them. So from I wouldn't say small scale, but from an immediate threat analysis of an active shooter all the way through the huge stuff, it does come down to people coming down to working and to reaching out and doing those things. And for that being said, you know, Judd, I'll give you the last comments here, but from my end, you know, thank you so much for coming on and sharing those insights with me. I appreciate that. And the fact that you called me brother, I always tell people, if a military guy says brother, then you know you're on the in crowd. So, you know, thank you so much for coming on the show. Talking with
it
you.
Is a term of endearment for me because I'm one of 8 children.
Holy cow.
I've got 5 brothers. And look, I've never had to go outside my family for much. So if I call you brother, you're definitely in the club.
We're in the club. Awesome.
Like, to your last point, I tell people there's no maximum effective range for please and thank you. Those are, I mean, it costs you nothing, and what you get, it's like you said, having manners, being polite.
Yeah.
You know, when I was still in uniform, people would tell me that I should be a professional in processor because every time I got to a new job, I was like shovel ready on day 2, you know, where everyone else was like in processing for 2 weeks, sometimes even a month, just to get accounts set up. And everyone always asked me, how do you do it? I mean, are you related to everybody in the Department of Defense? I'm like, no. I'm like, you would not believe how far please and thank you will go, especially the Beltway. I mean, in the Pentagon, where they won't even tell you, they won't even say good morning when you pass them in the hall, or if you say good morning, they, you know, I'm like, what the hell?
Like, what's wrong?
Yeah. So, I mean, your final point, maybe the most important point of this entire podcast is, you know, be a good person, be a good human being. You know, please and thank you and have manners and respect, you know. And when I was growing up, we had a class. I went to parochial school, but it was after recess, and it was a good time to have it. It was called politeness because we had been out on the schoolyard brawling and fighting and raising hell and pulling the girls' hair. And so we had politeness class afterwards. And to this day, I know how to set the table where the salad fork is all the way on the outside and the soup spoons on the opposite side because I went through politeness class. Hmm. Politeness is a lost art and manners. But it just comes down to being a good person, like you said. And, you know, I'll leave you with this. Abraham Lincoln said, the fastest way to make an enemy into a friend is to ask him for a favor.
Like,
so when I'm in some of these interagency meetings and there's this one guy that's just dominating, he's the SCS or the GS-15 that has more degrees than a thermometer with some whiz kid from Stanford or Harvard or MIT, I'll just ask that person for a favor or ask him or her for some advice. You would be shocked how fast you win them over. You have a friend for life in a lot of times, and they'll do anything for you. Yeah. So yeah, your last point, I think, may be the most important point of the entire podcast.
I don't know if I made the point so much as you made the point. So maybe we'll share credit on that one. You know, and I said I wasn't going to talk anymore, but I'm going to say one more thing. Thank you for coming on to the podcast and for accepting the invite. I was raised to always say please and thank you and sir and ma'am, and I still believe those are polite things. And, you know, treating people with dignity and respect. You know, every person on earth, if they just treat everybody with a little more dignity and respect, even if they think they're below them, which is BS, there's no such thing as that, you know, it would move mountains. So many problems would just go away with that. So, thank you again for coming on, for taking the time with me. For everybody who's tuning in, thank you. This is like the Thank You Now, the podcast. Thank you for tuning in. If you want to say thank you to Judd, the easiest ways to do that, you got a couple different ways. You got to give us a 5-star rating and subscribe. Of course, we say that every time. But if you got something out of this podcast, send us a message. We'll pass it on to Judd. You can put it on social media. You can ask your questions there. If you have found a way that you have overcome, you know, issues in your job, we would love to know what those are. And make sure you keep tuning in. Again, social media for Disaster Tough Podcast. Send us a message if you want to talk with Judd. And, of course, we got to give a shout-out to Pat Mahaney and Chris DeRuiter and John Spencer. We brought him up before. So, good guys.
Pat.
There you go. There was the bad thing. So, and we'll see you for the next one. Peace.